Have you ever needed to find someone's phone number and you decided that you would call information to get it? I think we've all done that from time to time. The operator or computer will ask you for what city or state, and after you get the phone number, the recording says, for an additional 50 cents, press 1, and you will automatically be connected. Familiar with that? Now, let's say you use this information service twice in 1 month, and you went ahead and pressed 1 so that you wouldn't have to physically dial the number yourself. But this time, the recording didn't say anything about an additional 50 cent charge to use the service. So a few weeks later, you get a phone bill and you notice that there are two 50 cent charges. Now what would you do? Pay it? It's only a dollar. I hope you wouldn't. You might consider what the phone company did to be very unethical, and it also showed perhaps a lack of integrity. Imagine if the phone companies did that. I would guarantee you would hear about it on some of the TV magazines. Unfortunately, mechanics are famous for this. Now, I am by no means stereotyping all mechanics. Not all do what I'm about to share with you, but let me know if this has happened to you before. You go to get your car fixed, and you're told by a mechanic one price to have the job done. When you come back to pick up your car, you get a completely different price, obviously a higher one. So you mention it to them, and you tell them about the difference in price, and then you question it. Now, we both know very well that they aren't going to say, well, that's how we make more money here. You know, we fix something else and charge for it, but we don't let you know about it first. We tell you after the job's done. They all have the same excuse. Well, when we started working on the car, we noticed that this part was really bad and it needed to be fixed and repaired. Some go as far as showing you the part. Now, granted, it may have been ready for replacing and may very well need it to, but if it's a used car, it probably had 100 other parts that needed to be replaced too. Doing something like this is wrong and unethical. What's in question here is not the fact that the additional repair needed to be done. It's the fact that it was done without the permission of the client. If the phone companies can't get away with charging you 50 cents without your permission, why should it be right for a mechanic to charge you $50 or $100 or more without your permission? Unfortunately, a lot of people don't pursue in really getting these problems solved right. They just go ahead and pay for it. And by now, you're already upset anyway, and you're not going to wait around to have the mechanic take off the new part that you didn't authorize and have him put on the old one, even though we really should. It's obvious why some mechanics do this. They make more what? Well, they make more money, but they forgot one of the most important things, didn't they? They forgot about the shelf life of the customer. The extra $50 or $100 that they badgered the customer out of is far less than what they would have made over the lifetime of the customer. Notice I said what they would have made, past tense. They have already lost that customer. They also forgot the fact that the customer is now going to talk and tell their friends who are going to tell their friends. All that for an extra $50 or $100. How sad. The way for the mechanic to gain the trust and respect for the customer is to tell them that if they find something else that needs fixing, they would call them, or they will call if they find other problems that need to be done for more than maybe, say, $100. Now, that's how you develop customers for life who will also tell their friends and who will tell their friends, too. Isn't that a better way to do things? Not to mention that the fact that doing business this way lets you what? Lets you sleep at night, doesn't it? We must keep in mind that customers are not stupid. We must treat them with respect, and we all need them. Don't chase them away with unethical tactics. You know, I travel all over the country, and I get to go to other parts of the world, and I have noticed a very negative trend in taking care of the customer. I see this very heavily, especially in the aviation business. You know, the lack of integrity and ethics in the aviation business blows me away. I think I've been able to discover why. The aviation business is generally made up of pilots and mechanics. And some of these pilots and mechanics want to start their own companies, but have little or no experience in business. Their skills basically are focused on flying and the mechanical work, the turning of the wrenches. Trying to make a buck is now more important for some of them than keeping that customer happy and keeping them for life. Again, please understand that I'm not saying this applies to all people in this industry. Now let me share with you some horror stories of mine, and as you're listening to this program, perhaps you could think about how you would handle these situations that I'm about to share with you. I was flying to New York to do a talk show, and I knew that once I got there, my airplane would have to have the oil changed. By the time that I would arrive, I would be right at my time limit for the oil change. Every 25 or 50 hours or so, you have to have the oil change. It depends on the type of airplane you have. It's not like cars. You know, you can go maybe an extra 500 or 1,000 miles, and it may be no big deal. with airplanes, it may be actually illegal for you to go beyond the 25 or the 50-hour limit before changing the oil. So several days before I arrived at the airport, I made plans to have my oil changed at the FBO, or the fixed based operator. Pilots refer to it as an FBO. It's the company or companies that are located on the airport, and they offer their services such as maintenance and fuel and that type of thing. So I called and told the gentleman that I had already purchased the oil, the filters, and the additional additives for the oil change. All I wanted them to do was supply the labor, and that's it. So he told me the cost would be about $100. I then called 3 hours before we landed to give them the exact time of my landing so that it would make it easier for them to fit me in and adjust their schedule, being that I was only going to be there for one day. I landed the airplane, and the manager said to me that there was no way that they could change my oil. Now, this was after making 3 phone calls to the company to confirm this and calling just several hours in advance. I had to have the oil changed because I was right at my legal maximum. I then had no choice but to find somebody else, another FBO on the field, who was just, unfortunately, as unprofessional. The other company took my oil, 2 filters, and other additives to do the oil change. I arrived the next day, and I was charged about $300 to change the oil plus the filter. The manager said he only received 1 filter from us. I'm wondering, why is he charging me for a filter? Well, that's why. Well, I specifically gave them 2, and I'd bet my life on it, and I told him so. So what did he do? Absolutely nothing. Isn't that terrible? What a way to treat customers. Him telling me that I only bought 1 filter was the same as him calling me a what? The same as him calling me a liar. The airplane I brought up there had 2 engines, and I brought 1 filter per engine. So now instead of my oil change costing me $100, it cost me $300. So now instead of my oil change costing me $100, it cost me now $300. So I figured the next time I go back to that airport, I would rather go to another FBO. Well, I happened to go back up to New York for another talk show. The first 2 FBOs I would not go back to. So my next trip, I went to this other one. Well, this time, the winds when I landed were 30 miles an hour, and it was in like 30-degree temperature, and it was raining cold, just very nasty. On the day we arrived, we asked the people there that we needed to have the aircraft pulled out to the front of the airport the next day and refueled, ready to go, because I had to depart immediately. And then I also told them the exact time that we would need to leave the next day. Well, the next day arrives, we get to the airport, and the weather is exactly the same. And unfortunately, my airplane wasn't out front, and to top it off, it wasn't even fueled up. So I asked the manager if he could please bring the airplane to the front so that my family and friends who accompanied me wouldn't have to walk in the freezing rain. It would have been a good 4 or 5 minute walk. They refused. The reason they refused is because they wanted the extra space out front so that if a jet pulled up, they would be able to put them there so they couldn't get wet. They wanted the jet's passengers happier because jets hold more fuel than the smaller airplane that I happened to be flying that day, which means they would make more money from the jet because obviously the jet would take more fuel on the order. So instead of getting to depart right away, we got out to the airport. It took them an hour to locate the airplane and fuel it up. I was 1 hour behind schedule, not to mention how soaked we were. Needless to say, I wasn't a happy camper. When I arrived back into my office the next day, I wrote the manager a letter. I have a picture of the jet that I fly on my letterhead, and I didn't happen to fly the jet up there on this particular trip, so I mentioned in the letter I know that next time if I want better service at his establishment, that I will make sure that I arrive in a jet. That was really a bad move on his part. Not a way to treat a customer. You can only imagine where I will not be going the next time, especially when I take a jet. I had major problems with 3 out of the 4 FBOs at this airport, and all these problems could have easily been solved if someone had a little common sense about business and understood how a customer feels and what a customer's needs are. Well, here's another example for you. I had an oil leak on one of my engines, and I asked a mechanic to look at the airplane to see if they could figure out where the oil leak was coming from and then tell me what he thought caused it and what the cost would be to fix it. Now, this conversation was all done over the phone, and I had gotten the impression that he did go over to my airplane to see where the leak was that I described and where it was coming from. He told me he could fix it, but he had to remove the cowling and inspect it further. So I told him to go ahead and do that, take a look at it, and then call me with a price. Now, he said he could fix it, and it would be about, I think if I remember correctly, it was about $800. And I told him to go ahead, but if it was any more than that, that he needed to call me. Well, of course, he called me, and he found some more leaks, and he told me how much that would cost to fix, and I went ahead and told him to go ahead and do it. I picked up the airplane a few days later, and I paid him about $2,500 to fix this oil leak. That's right, $2,500. Now, I flew the airplane soon after, and once I landed, I decided I'd look under the belly to see if the oil leak stopped. It didn't. $2,500 later, there was the leak, and it was no better. I called him and told him about this. You will love his response. He said, "I fixed all the leaks I saw, and they aren't leaking." Well, that might be true, but he didn't fix the major oil leak that I brought to his attention. In fact, he never looked at the leak I told him about. It was so obvious, I would land the airplane, and seconds after I landed, I would see oil dripping on the tarmac. Well, I was pretty upset about it by this time. So I took the airplane back to him, and I physically pointed to the leak. He eventually found the exact cause. It was a clamp on a hose that was loose. Originally, the hose was really metal, and someone replaced it with a rubber hose, and that was seeping the oil because the clamp wasn't tight enough. So I asked him if he'd be willing to fix it. Well, he said yes, of course, but that would cost another $500 to $800. So I asked him if he planned to swallow the cost of it or at least the labor. Now, granted, he may have fixed the other leaks, but the other leaks he fixed had nothing to do with the major leak that I pointed out to him that I thought he looked at. I didn't have to spend the $2,500. For another $5,000 or so, I could have had a brand new rebuilt engine. So after asking him what he would do about it, he asked me what I thought he should do. I simply told him if he were my customer, I would do it for free so I wouldn't lose the customer. You'll love his comment on this one. "Well, I'm sorry, but I don't work for free." But I said you should. Now, what vital lessons did this gentleman forget? He forgot to remember the shelf life of the customer. He got $2,500 from me that he didn't deserve, and he wouldn't have swallowed the $500 so he could make thousands of dollars more with me later because my shelf life would have been worth that or more. How foolish. He also forgot that customers talk, and some talk more than others. Recall earlier that we talked about the marketing skills of actually working sometimes for free? Sometimes we should. Now, I've had customers that weren't happy, whether it be directly my company's fault or not, or maybe my personal fault or not. But to solve this problem, I might give them a free consultation or maybe some free tapes. It's cheaper to do that in the long run. This gentleman let his ego get in the way of saving a customer. "I don't work for free." He let the customer assume all the risks. "Oh, and by the way, I took my airplane to another mechanic, and all he had to do was tighten the screw on the clamp and no more leak." I thought I would also let you know that in some of these examples, I didn't tell you a lot of the final outcomes or the details and also how I pursued solving the problems or getting my money back. That's really not the important part anyway. But let's take a moment to try to understand what in the world would compel a person or a company to treat customers like this. Now, for small companies, it usually stems from money. The company that did you wrong may not have the money and can't afford the quote-unquote financial loss. So to admit that they were wrong would mean that they would have to solve the problem, and then that would mean they would have to fork out extra money. Money that they may not really have. So they feel it's easier to fight you tooth and nail, damage their reputation, and have an unhappy customer in comparison to doing the job over and right and shelling out the extra money that they would have to put out. As a small business, that can be very difficult to try to solve this type of problem. The money that it would take to do the job right and hopefully keep the customer might be really your paycheck for the week. Not to mention that once you do finish the job and do it right, there are no guarantees that you're going to keep that customer. Now, that could really hurt. But in a nutshell, companies that won't back up their work or products ultimately don't put enough emphasis on keeping the customer happy and remembering that the customer has a shelf life and moving lips that talk, talk, talk. Then there is the pride factor of admitting, if need be, that you or your employee or coworker might have messed up. And that's really a tough thing to do, isn't it? For most people, admitting that they were wrong, well, that isn't really their favorite pastime. I once met a man who was a master at keeping the customer happy. You probably will recognize his name. His name was Sam Walton, founder of Walmart, and he built an incredible empire, didn't he? One of the major foundations on which he built his company was the fact that he wanted to satisfy the customer. His employees or associates are masters at doing that, especially when it comes time to refunding their money. Now, my wife likes to shop there, and from time to time, she has to take certain items back for exchange or for a refund. It's virtually hassle-free, and sometimes you don't even need a receipt. Imagine that. Now, some people might argue and say, yeah, but Gary, they can afford to do that. They make millions and millions of dollars, and if my company made as much as they did, I could afford to treat my customers this way too. And that might be true, but let's think this through. Do you think that one day after Sam built his business and was making millions of dollars in sales, that he had this brainstorm of an idea and said, now that we're making money and we have a strong cash flow, let's really treat the customer right and make refunds hassle-free? No, that's silly. How did he get to the point of making those millions of dollars? He started with a little business, and he had this philosophy from the beginning and continued to appreciate its effectiveness, probably more so as he grew his business. That's how he got there. Now, I'm sure there were times that he couldn't afford to refund the customer's money or exchange an item, but he probably did it anyway. Now, if we think we have to wait till our businesses are booming before we can treat customers like Sam did, we'll be waiting a long, long time. A gentleman that I know that subscribes to this type of business practice has really got his business to grow. Yes, back to another one of my aviation experiences, but this one, well, it's a better one, thank goodness. I went to this gentleman's company to have my radio of one of my airplanes fixed and repaired. One of his employees had told me it was ready and I could come by and pick it up. Now, I got there on Friday because I was going to pick it up and put it in the airplane, and I was going to give some flying instructions that weekend. I like to fly and give lessons when I have the time to do that. So I went into the store and I asked them for my radio, and no one knew a thing about it. Now, that means I didn't have a radio and I couldn't fly the airplane. And I have to have a means of communicating to get in and out of the airport. So I would have to now cancel all my lessons that I had scheduled for that weekend if I couldn't get my radio. Needless to say, they never found it that day, and of course I left without it. So I went back the following Monday to see the manager, and I told him what happened. Well, he knew exactly where it was, and it was ready. So the cost of the repair was about $150. He said that he was sorry, and the bill was on the house. Now, that was a smart thing for him to have done. If he had not done that, I would have walked, and you know what I mean. Now, granted, I lost more money from canceling the lessons than the cost of the repair, but he did try to help me, and I do understand how those problems can happen. Of course, I needed to be reasonable on my part too, but the bottom line was that he tried to take care of the customer. Now, I have to admit that I wasn't the greatest at keeping my customers happy all the time, especially when I started my business. You know, when you're 16 and you own your own business, all you think about is bringing in that dollar. I didn't have much experience in working with the customer, and I had to learn that. I've got to share with you one experience that really sticks out in my mind. When I was 15 years old, I made an attempt to try to get my first jewelry account, and here's what I mean by that. Many jewelry stores don't have their own jewelers in-house, so they farm or they contract the work out. This is what an account is. So if you had four accounts or four jewelry stores that you would do work for, you would go to each one of the jewelry stores every couple days or so, and you would pick up their jewelry that needed to be repaired, and then in a couple days again, you would bring it back when the repair was all done. So here I am, 15 years old, trying to get some of these accounts. Now keep in mind, at 15, I couldn't even drive. So I had my mother drive me to the jewelry stores. She stayed in the car while I went in to try to sell my services. I look back at it now and think, wow, that was pretty bold. Believe me, I looked every bit of 15 years of age. Now I remember going into one particular jewelry store where I met the manager. His name was Ken. I think Ken was absolutely thrown back that a 15-year-old kid was quote-unquote a jeweler. He couldn't believe his eyes. You know, when you think of a jeweler, you probably think of, you know, this guy with these little magnifying glasses thing in the eye and, you know, the gray hair and so forth. And I think Ken was really looking for somebody quite a bit older. Now, to make a long story short, Ken gave me the account. I would like to think he was impressed so much that he gave it to me, but I think he probably felt sorry for me. Either way, it was cool. He did have some conditions, though. He would only allow me to solder and repair gold chains. I wasn't to be given any rings to size or any other repair other than these gold chains. Now, Ken had an older gentleman. Yes, that's the man with the glasses and the magnifying loop in the eye and the gray hair. That gentleman did all the major work. He did everything except for the chain solders. So now my mom would bring me to the jewelry store, because remember, I didn't have a car, and she would help me go to the store, pick up the jewelry, and then in a day or two, I would have her take me back. I soon turned 16. Boy, I was happy about that, and I bought my first car. After that, I took a simple silversmithing course, and that's how I learned to start repairing jewelry. I didn't realize it till later, but my teacher really wasn't that good, but I learned enough to get by. Now, Ken, the manager of the store, thought I might want to meet the other jeweler, and I did, so he put me in contact with him. I had the chance to spend some time with him, and I learned some of his techniques, and let me tell you, this man was incredible. He was good. He had years and years of experience. But I'll never forget our first conversation. He looks me in the eyes and he said, "Gary, you can fix all the gold chains that you want. My eyesight isn't as good as it used to be. You can have them all. But don't you dare take any work from Ken other than chain repairs." He about scared me to death. Of course, before I met Ken, my goal was to have Ken give me all of his work. Now I was really scared. But I knew that I would eventually get the entire account. You see, as I was spending time with the jeweler, I realized that he had a bit of a drinking problem, if you know what I mean. He'd be sipping on the stuff while he would work. Now, one day I get a call from Ken. He said, "Gary, we need you desperately. Our jeweler got drunk, and now he's missing, and we have no idea where he's at. We have a lady in here who just bought a 1-carat diamond from us, and she wants to put it on her gold band. It's got to be done tomorrow, or we're going to lose the sale, and we can't find the other jeweler. Do you know how to do this?" Now I'm really scared. All I could hear in my mind was this gentleman, this older jeweler, saying, "Don't you dare take any work other than chain repairs." So I shared this with Ken. He said that he didn't care, he's the boss, and it means a big sale. Okay, I'm in now. He asked me if I knew how to do this job, so I told Ken I did. What else am I going to say? He didn't ask me if I had done this type of job before. He just asked if I knew how to do this type of work. Now, I've never laid an egg before, but I know what to do with it. I was at that store to pick up that ring before Ken could hang up his phone. So I took it home, and I started working on it. Now, at that time, I had never even had a jeweler's bench to do my work on. I converted a wooden desk where I used to actually keep my underwear and socks. I converted that into a jeweler's bench. It was obvious to any jeweler, if they came and saw me and watched my work, that I really didn't have much experience. In fact, the middle of this desk had actually turned to literal charcoal because I heated it up so much with my torch. Oh well, so I took this ring and I studied it a bit. The first thing I had to do was to drill a hole in the dead center of the ring so I could fit and solder what's known as a peg head. The peg head is the white gold piece that has the prongs that hold the diamond in. The bottom of the head is connected to a peg that fits in the hole that you drill. Now, I didn't have any experience at all in doing this. Now, mistake number one was I drilled the hole off-center about a half a millimeter. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but when you're only working with a 6 or a 8 millimeter width band, a half a millimeter is a lot. So I guess I'd figure out later on how to solve this problem. So now I placed the peg in the hole, and I added my solder, and I lit the torch. And I put the torch close to the ring, and the ring is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. The solder just wouldn't melt and cement the peg head to the ring. The ring is still getting hotter until I actually melted it on one side. Oh man, I literally freaked. I'll never in my life forget this. And remember too, I was barely 16 years old. What in the world was I going to do? Though I hate to admit it, the first thing I did was cry my eyes out. Then I ran to the next room and showed my mother what was going on. I had no idea how to solve this problem. So I frantically called my teacher and I begged and pleaded with him for his help. He told me what to do over the phone. It kind of worked out, I guess. You remember the hole that I drilled that was a half a millimeter off on one side? Well, I melted the ring on the opposite side, and once I filed the melted part down and off, about a half a millimeter's worth, the diamond now looks centered. That was a major relief, but the nightmare wasn't over yet. After taking the ring back to the jewelry store, the manager noticed that there was a spot on the ring and it needed to be buffed off. He said for me not to worry about it because he's going to have somebody else in the jewelry store buff it out with a machine that they had. So now the next day I get a call from the jewelry store and they tell me that while someone was buffing the ring, the entire peg head with the diamond fell right off. I was just about to pass out. So I'm trying to act as if it's no big deal. "Oh really? Glad the customer hasn't gotten it yet. You guys must have buffed it too hard. Well, I'll come in and get it right away." The stress level was just too much for a 16-year-old kid. And I knew whose fault it was. I did a terrible job soldering it. And you can imagine now what's going through my head. Oh no, I've got to solder this thing again. I was so scared to touch this ring, much less to even look at it again. Anyway, I finally finished it, and I never saw that ring again. What a relief. I had such a makeshift operation, it was pathetic. I didn't even have a real safe to keep the store's jewelry in. So I made my own safe. I saw an advertisement for a wall safe that was really a fake electrical outlet. You may have seen these before. So I bought it, then I cut a hole in my wall in my bedroom, and I placed this fake outlet in the hole. So now all you have to do is you just have to turn the screw that's in between the little sockets there, turn it just a bit, and it'll pull right out, and then you place the jewelry in the container that was connected to the wall socket, and that was my safe. There are unfortunately times, though, that I didn't do a great job, and I fought the customer tooth and nail so I wouldn't redo the ring, mainly because I couldn't afford to. And can you imagine if I had to replace that one ring that I started to melt? I barely had a dime to my name, and my mother and her husband didn't either. I would have really been up a creek without a paddle. Well, if I had to do it over again, and I needed to redo someone's jewelry even though I didn't have the money to do it, well, I would borrow the money to make it right. Unfortunately, I didn't think that way, and lots of companies don't. It's not a way to treat paying customers. I recall this one customer that I had so much trouble with. Now, I don't recall exactly what the problem was, but I do remember I did everything I could to avoid her, which was not professional either. She was probably right. Customers many times are if you're constantly trying to avoid them. Somehow, she had gotten my home phone number, and she kept calling and she kept calling, and she would leave all these messages. So here is what I did. It wasn't right, and it certainly wasn't professional. You ever heard those recordings before on the telephone when you dial a wrong number? You know what it's like. It goes something like, we're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dial. If you feel you've reached a number in error, please check the number and try your call again. So what I did is I kept on dialing phone numbers until I heard this recording, and then I recorded it and I put it on my answering machine. So now when she called, she would get that recording and she thought my phone number was disconnected. Isn't that crazy? She eventually tracked me down and we finally solved the problem. But that's sometimes some of the stupid, crazy things that we do, and it's so unprofessional and it's so wrong. Anyway, I guess I'll have to chalk that up to youth. You know, customers, they're not stupid. Because of being in the jewelry business, I've learned early in my business that customers must trust you. They will test you to see if you or your company are trustworthy. Before I spend a large amount of money with a company, I do my very best to check them out. I recall flying to a nearby town one day to look at an airplane that I was interested in buying, and I'll tell you this experience, it's quite interesting. The owner of the company came out to meet me, and he told me that the airplane that I was interested in was $55,000, and that was the lowest he could sell it to me for. Now here's his story. He said that he needed to get rid of the airplane, and that's exactly what he paid for it, $55,000. Then he told me some guy owned it and he flew it out of this small airport, and he told me the name of the airport. Then he said the guy eventually died of AIDS, and that's how he acquired the airplane. Now, one of my millionaire mentors taught me something, and if you're taking notes, you might want to write this down. And if you're not taking notes, you might want to write this down. He taught me not to believe everything you hear. And believe me, I don't. So after looking the airplane over, I told him that I would call him if I decided to follow through. Now, after I realized that his story didn't sound right, I decided to investigate it a little further. Now, he gave me some clues that tipped me off, so I decided to check into them. First, he said that he would sell me the plane for what he paid for it. Now, that could possibly be true, but I doubt it. He had an inventory of over 15 or more airplanes. Now, how can you afford to have 15 or more airplanes to sell and stay in business if you don't sell your product for more than what you pay for it? You've got to make a profit. The second and the third clue was that he told me what airport the airplane was based at, and the gentleman that owned it died of AIDS. Really? So I did some more homework. With three phone calls, I was able to contact the airport that he flew out of, and I eventually got to talk to the dead man with AIDS. He wasn't dead with AIDS. He was alive and well. He told me that he sold the airplane for $30,000. Interesting. The moral of the story? Don't lie to your customers to make a sale, because one day you're going to get a Gary Cox who will find out how honest you and your company really are. The point here, too, is if this man lied to me about all this, how in the world could I trust him when he tells me that the airplane runs great and everything is up to date and everything is safe? You lie to me once, You'll lie to me twice. And by the way, doing my homework like this when purchasing an airplane really isn't unusual. By contacting the previous owners, you can find out information good and bad about the airplane. You can get information maybe that the present seller might not want to reveal. Now, as to selling and making a profit on the airplane, I didn't have a problem with that. The problem I had was that this gentleman lied to me. Do you ever think I bought that airplane or any airplanes from him? Not a chance. And since then, I've purchased several airplanes, which I could have purchased from him. He not only lost future sales, he also lost his integrity and trust with a customer. I'd like to share with you a great way to develop a tremendous amount of trust with your customers. Always follow through on what you tell them that you're going to do, especially the little stuff. If you tell a customer or prospect that you're going to call them at 3 o'clock, then you make sure you call them at 3 o'clock. Now, if you call them at 5 when you said 3, it may not be a big deal, but it is a little strike against you. It strengthens the bond of trust by calling at the time you say you would. Now, here's the excuse that I'll usually get when this happens to me. A salesperson might check on something for me, and they might say something like, "Well, let me find the answer for you, and I'll call you back by the end of the day." So the end of the day comes, and I get no phone call. So the next day comes around, and I get the phone call from this individual, the salesperson. Then I ask them, "Why didn't you call me yesterday as promised?" The response, "Well, I didn't have an answer yet." Doesn't matter though, does it? He said that he would call at the end of the day. He didn't say if he didn't find the answer, he wouldn't call me. He said he would call me at the end of the day. I know this sounds awful petty or picky to some of you, but if you develop a track record of trust with your customers with the little things, they're going to trust you with the big things. With some of my clients, I'll make up reasons to follow up with them on something so that I subconsciously begin a track record of them trusting me. It's simple. Here's how you do it. All you have to do is make up, and I use these words loosely, make up a reason to follow through on something. Tell them that you're going to mail them something they showed interest in, and what you're going to mail them may not be directly related to the actual sale you're trying to make, and then you mail it and make sure you do it. Maybe you'll tell them they'll stop by at the end of the week when there's no real reason to do so, then you make sure you do. Maybe you'll tell them you'll call them tomorrow about whatever. Then when tomorrow comes, make sure you call them. Now, when I say that make sure you do some of these things when there's no real reason to do them, what do I mean by that? Well, obviously, if you were making a sale with a customer and you said to them, "When can I pick up the check?" and they said, "Well, come by tomorrow and pick up the check," are you going to make sure you're going to be there tomorrow? Absolutely, you're motivated by picking up the check. So tomorrow you're going to pick up the check. You're not developing a track record of trust because you told them tomorrow you're going to pick up the check and you show up. You're motivated by just getting the check. But if you said to them after the sale, "Hey, I'd like to call you next Friday just to make sure everything is going okay and working fine," now you've already got the money in hand. You may not be so motivated to call them next week to see if everything's okay. Then next week, the day you tell them, you make sure you call them. Doing things like this develops a track record of trust. And when they know they can trust you for the little things, they'll be able to trust you for the big things. As simple as it may seem, when you do things like this, you cause your client to develop a measure of trust in you. You tell them that you're going to do something, and they know that you are a man or a woman of your word. You make doing business a pleasure with you when your customers feel this way about how you do business. Now, when we stop to think about this, it all stems from treating customers the way that we want or deserve to be treated. We often go into a defensive mode when a customer is upset about something and they're venting their problem to us. The next time a customer comes to you with a problem, pause for a second and immediately tell yourself, "I am that customer." Put yourself in their shoes as quick as you can. It's amazing how calm many times, how understanding, and how reasonable they will become because they know or they feel that you're on their side. Now, let me give you an example of what it's like to get somebody to really know or feel that you're on their side. I remember one day being in line at the post office, and there was a gentleman with his girlfriend buying some stamps. I was about, 10th in line, so I still had a long wait. Now, something caused this man to snap, and I don't recall exactly what it was all about, but he started yelling and carrying on, and the people behind the counter that worked for the post office, they had no idea what to do. Let me tell you, I thought this man fit the bill for some serious problems. And he kept on saying, "I can't believe you did this to me." And as he was saying that, I decided that I would get out of line, and I went up to him, and I immediately took his side. Here's what I did. I said, "They did what to you? And then he started telling me, and I said to him, I can't believe they did that. See, he felt I immediately took his side and became his partner. So he started talking to me as if we knew each other for years. Within seconds of the yelling, he walked out of the post office with me without any further problems. Now, I wouldn't recommend that you do this by any means, but I really thought something major was about to develop and it wasn't for the good. Now, I didn't do anything special. I simply put myself in his shoes. He thought that I was on his side. I understood, but I did not agree with his cause, if you will. I just put myself in his shoes. The more that you can focus on doing that, the quicker you will be able to diffuse problems with customers. Let the customer vent, and as they're venting, think, shelf life, and that this is a valuable customer. Now, I find when I put myself in my customer's shoes, I usually become very fair in trying to solve their problems. If you don't put yourself in their shoes, you'll usually become defensive, and you're not going to be willing to work out the problem and try to keep that customer happy. I remember once taking one of my cars to a detail shop to have cleaned, and I had owned this car for about 4 years at that time. I knew every little nook and cranny on that car. I went back to pick up the car, and as I started the car, I noticed that a knob had been broken. You know, it was the knob that you turn to zero out the odometer that keeps a track of how many miles you drive on a trip, and you can just zero it out anytime. And without that knob, I was unable to do that. I brought it to the attention of the man in charge, and he said it was already like that. And then he asked the man who actually worked on the car, and he said it was like that too. Now, wait a minute. I own this car for 4 years, turn this knob every time I fill up the tank, and he's going to tell me that it was already broken? They never saw me again. The manager was about 50 years old. He should have known better. That's not the way to run a business. Recently, though, I had a much better experience with someone who detailed my car. After this young man finished the car, I got in it and all the electrical components didn't work. The car started, but it had no radio, no interior lights, and I didn't feel it was just a coincidence. He must have done something that caused it. So I called him and I told him about the problem. And by the way, this man was only in his early 20s. He didn't pass the blame off, he didn't blame me, and he didn't even blame himself. He said he'd be right over, and he was. He knew to check in the fuse box, and he noticed that one of the fuses were blown. So he brought it into my office and he showed me. Now, he said he could have done it, then he mentioned that some water could have shortened it. Who knows? He never made excuses, he never blamed it on me. I think he felt comfortable with the fact that I wouldn't lie to him about how this happened. All I know, it happened immediately after he worked on it. The bottom line was he took care of the customer. Before pointing fingers, which he never did, he came and evaluated the situation. Now that's a person that I want to do business with, wouldn't you? So as we wrap up with this segment, remember to be honest with your customers, take some losses once in a while to keep them happy, and always put yourself in their shoes when problems arise. Before producing this program, I sent out an email telling everyone that I was putting this series together. I mentioned in the email that one of my millionaire mentors was willing to take questions about their success in their business, and we would have them answered on the program. We received many excellent questions. You'll certainly want to pay strict attention to this next part. Recall earlier that I told you that I had learned the jewelry business when I was younger, and I had a family friend sell me the jewelry, which I sold in school. Well, it's that friend who became one of my millionaire mentors, and that's who you are going to have the opportunity to listen to today. His name is Manu. It's M-A-N-U, Manu. He, like myself, is also originally from Jamaica. Now, while listening to him, you will note the incredible mindset that he has developed. As you hear these questions being answered, ask yourself, how similar is my mindset to his? No, I'm not asking if you agree with his mindset, but do you act on it? That's the difference. You'll also notice that we are not recommending what business to start because it really doesn't matter to a large degree. It's the person and the thinking and attitude behind the business. Apply these principles in this next segment and you'll have no choice but to see results, results, results. Here's to your success.